We get things underway this hour by welcoming to the program a music correspondent, publicist, a host of That Eric Alper on Sirius XM Radio, the multi-talented Eric Alper joins us. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you are so going to regret that word, multi. Talk to my wife.
Oh,
how are you? So good to talk to you.
Well, it's great to talk with you. I've enjoyed your work. I love following you on Twitter. And later I want to talk about your social media presence and what's so great about it. But let's get a little history of you first. You were drawn to the music business at a pretty early age. I read along the way that you had a subscription to Billboard, well, like most 12-year-olds do.
You know, for me, the music industry was my science fiction world, where some people get into that fantasy world. The music industry for me was like that as a kid and as a teenager. I loved reading the stories about the musicians. I loved reading about the band. I loved reading about the people that worked at the record labels. I loved it all. It was right then and there, as an 8-year-old, after watching the movie American Hot Wax, which told the story of Alan Freed, kind of creating the rock and roll movement in Cleveland back in the 50s. I said, that's what I want to do. I have no idea how. I have no idea if this is even possible, but I'm going to figure it all out. And then, so my first kind of instance was getting a Billboard magazine as a teenager.
That's so funny. American Hot Wax, one of my favorite movies growing up as well. Your grandfather also played a pretty big role in opening up the world of music to you through what he did for a living.
Yeah, there's a bar in Toronto that's still standing called Grossman's Tavern. And it was the first bar in Toronto and one of the first in Canada to have live music. And then later on was one of the first to have an alcohol license, because the city of Toronto thought that mixing alcohol and music would make the entire city go to hell in a handbasket. And they were right. And so that led to Grossman's Tavern being one of the very few places in Toronto where you can actually tour and stop and play. So that kind of community spirit that my family and that I grew up on was one of, not necessarily loving music for music's sake, but seeing it as part of your community and as your city. Having really great times and an occupation. My whole family worked there at one time or another. And in the late 60s, Grossman's Tavern was one of the places where the draft dodgers used to stay and hang out and hide out from the U.S. government that was trying to get them back into the country after they dodged the Vietnam draft. So for me, it was one of the coolest places that I could think of to kind of build what I thought was just a method of madness, really.
Were you one of those kids that when you got a record, that you didn't just listen to the record, but you read that label and you found out who wrote the song, who the producer was, and took in all of that information?
Yeah. It's so funny that you say that, because I don't tend to think of myself as a geek, even though that all the things that I do are perfectly lined up to being a geek. But I did. Like, I love certain artists on record labels. Like I saw things like Motown or Stax Record and the logos more heartwarming to me than, say, clothing company, labels. And I learned about brands. But more importantly to me, it was a chance to learn about the outside world. It was recognizing that the economic system, the political system, the racial system that the world operates on affects everything. It affects the art that we all love. It affects the movie studios, the book publishing companies, but more importantly, it affects the music. And when I realized in reading about, say, Bruce Springsteen hating school, but knowing everything about the world through the grooves of a 45 record, I kind of related to that. I did fine in school. I probably did better than Bruce did. But but at least I kind of saw my world through the eyes of these artists, until I realized that, oh, wait a second, I could actually do this too, much less forget about playing because I was horrible. But that was when I quickly realized that if I want to get in the music industry, I better figure out what I could do. And that's when I started working at record labels and then finally, owning up my own PR company later on.
So was it at university when you realized you weren't going to be a professional musician that the next best thing was to work with them?
I realized I was going to be a professional musician probably by the time I was 5. I mean, I was horrible. I have no musical talent whatsoever, and I still don't. In fact, if you put me in a studio, I would probably delete everything or erase everything. Because to me, I'm coming at it from a fan perspective, and I always have. I'm not technologically advanced whatsoever. I couldn't tell you why certain guitarists get certain sound out of their guitar. It's still magic to me. And I mean that with the best of intentions. I have really no concept of how certain sounds come out of certain things. In fact, even when I do my own radio show, I literally walk in, talk to artists for an hour, and walk out again. I don't know how to edit anything. It's not that I don't want to. It's like, I don't think I was really put on this planet to make other people sound good. So I'm fine with that.
My producer's smiling and nodding when you talked about, you know, walking in, doing the interviews and leaving. That's apparently ringing true for him.
Yeah, and like I think that you and I and like your producer were kind of the lucky ones where we kind of figure out what we like and then you try to make it a life. And you know, there's a lot of my friends who, I tend to kind of tell myself that I was smart enough to figure out how to get in this industry, but dumb enough to figure out not to leave. And so part of it is like, I just kept going and going. And like small businesses or large businesses, you just keep going because it's the only thing that you know how to do. A lot of the musicians that I work with on a daily basis did not have a plan B. They grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s, seeing music as a way out of their miserable lives and family and existence. So they slept on those couches. They slept on the floors. They played to a dog and a bartender at a venue, and they loved it because at least they weren't doing something that they hated to do. And I always felt that. I worked 7 days a week, always had 18 hours a day because I love doing what I'm doing. It's not work to me.
We're talking with Eric Alpert here on Downtown. So for anybody who doesn't know, what does a good publicist do for an artist?
Well, once the artist has and finishes their song or their video or the album, it's my job to tell the media about it. So I work alongside the daily newspapers and the music magazines and the magazines around the world, the radio stations and TV stations. And I do the interviews and previews and reviews. So I kind of use the media in order to get the artist's word out about what they're doing. And in turn, you know, people like you and I and the general public get to know about their stuff. So it's really working alongside the media, coming up with story ideas, coming up with different angles for the artist to kind of get heard rather than, hey, this person has a brand new album out. Because you can't really write 900 words or 1,000 words on that. There's got to be a really good story behind it. And like you, whenever you get pitched on somebody, it's a matter of finding, well, who's got a real interesting story that can talk for 15 minutes or 20 minutes?
You've been doing this for more than 25 years now. How has the job changed in that time?
You know what? It's interesting that the traditional gatekeepers of what we all grew up in our lives, meaning the Rolling Stone magazines or Spin magazines or even MTV, there were only a handful of people that could literally create a musician into a superstar overnight. And if everything clicked, that's how you got, you know, people like Guns N' Roses, and that's how you got an Elvis Presley. You didn't really see the behind-the-scenes struggling of it, but seemingly overnight, one spin on MTV could make or break somebody's career. That's not what happens now. We're all our own influencers. We're all our own television stations with the help of an iPhone or an Android phone in our pocket. We all have just as much of an equal value of a voice on something like Twitter or Facebook. We may not have the clout as, say, Beyonce talking about a brand new artist, but there are far more places to go for artists to get seen and heard. The bigger problem is that their competition is not another artist from their own city or state. Their competition are Bruce Springsteen and The Who and The Beatles and Diana Ross. It's every single artist that's available that makes up the 55 million songs available on Spotify or the 100 million different videos on YouTube. Because when an artist puts out something, their competition, because we're all going after the same eyes and ears as everybody else out there right now.
And you also, and again, it didn't work for everybody, probably didn't work for most people, but it's not like in the days when you had that record company behind you pushing for exposure, and often just being on a certain label might at least get your record played by music directors.
Yeah, you know, there's that thought process sometimes that it takes you, you know, your entire life to make your first album, and then you have 7 months to make your second album. And then if the third album doesn't break, you're dropped. Well, now, a lot of these artists that took three albums to break, like a Bruce Springsteen or Paul Simon or many of the other artists that slowly kind of found their own voice, there's none of that anymore. In fact, you don't even get to make an album until your first three songs get more than 10, 15, 20, even 30 million streams on Spotify. So it's really hard to have that long-lasting career when you're dealing with the singles world. But for older people that might be listening, it's probably no different than when they were music lovers back in the 50s and 60s too, where you didn't get to make an album until your first three songs broke big. So it's a little bit of a change from where being an artist trying to, you know, make 70 minutes worth of music to fit on a CD. Now you're lucky if people can listen to the whole album once because of all the different choices. And not just the music with, you know, Netflix and all the different books and right. television stations and radio stations that are available, even in your car or online. We're all in competition with the same eyes and ears as everybody else.
You've worked with some of the biggest names in the business, but I read an interview where you said you especially enjoy working with those artists whose perhaps biggest commercial successes are behind them. What is it about those particular artists that you enjoy?
They're nicer. they don't have 15 yes people around them catering to their every whim. I never really wanted to work with those kind of people. I wanted to work with people not that, you know, were kind of on the way down, but I wanted to work with really great people. And I just found that when having both sides of the coin, where I've worked with artists that were selling millions of copies around the world at the time, but I always found that when artists were on smaller independent labels, like say a Ringo Starr or Sinead O'Connor or Bob Geldof, those artists who sold millions of records years ago were pretty gracious of having that kind of help in other places. So they were happy to know that they still had 3,000 to 5,000 people in every city that could rely on them. There was something really special about not being in the eye of the hurricane all the time, when you can actually relax and breathe and enjoy what this life gave you. I found that those artists were a little bit easier to handle rather than those ones that came in with an entourage of 70 or 80 people with a big machine behind them, just trying to keep them going. Because there's no rule book on how to make it in this industry, and there's no rule book on how to sustain it or what happens 10 years later. So I always kind of felt that those artists, I kind of felt the kinship that we were truly all in this together, and we were in this industry for the love of the music.
Yeah, that's great that you say that, because I think sometimes becoming a star is a matter of luck and being in the right place at the right time. But carving out a career of several decades has to be about loving what you do. And I found that same experience on a much smaller level with guests here on the show, with some shows and local performances that we've booked around here, that the people who are just working musicians who had that success, whether it was 10 years ago or 40 years ago, do it for the right reason and love communicating with the fans and just being able to get out and do their art.
Yeah, and it's also a different kind of celebrity and a different kind of musician that we're seeing now anyway. I mean, you know, when you're 15 and 16 and 17 years old, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you want to become a musician essentially for two reasons. You want to get as rich as possible, and you want the girl who ignores you to notice you. I mean, that was what was really creating a whole universe full of musicians. Now you're seeing 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds having millions of followers on social media And it's so fast, and it's creating a different kind of celebrity. It's one that is fleeting. And I just found that the musicians that continue to put out music long after their hits were behind them were still continuing to do it for all of the right reasons. Not that those people weren't doing it in the beginning of it, but the fact that they continued to do it made it a little bit more enjoyable for me. And quite frankly, those people who were the gatekeepers of the television shows or the radio stations or people like your producer, we all grew up with some of the same music. So it was always great to hear stories about, hey, you know, thanks for sending that email about that artist. It's so weird because I saw them back in 1995 when I was in university. And you get to hear those stories about how their music has touched them. And as a publicist, there could be no greater method of to use music as a form of just communicating good times too.
What's your favorite part about hosting the SiriusXM show?
That nobody tells me what to do. because you sound exactly like the kind of radio person that I grew up listening to and that I love, and I wish I sounded like you, but I don't, and I can't. So I get to have fun and for an hour talking to three different musicians during the hour, and I get to be a fan, and I don't get to play too inside baseball. We don't talk about tech stuff too much because I'm still coming at it knowing that the listener may not even realize that that artist has 7 or 8 albums since that last massive hit. So I get to come across as just me, trying to sound like my favorite, DJ on SiriusXM, and I'm just so happy because I don't think I could do that because it would just come across as really inauthentic. But I get just talking to the people that I grew up listening to, and then at the end of it all, getting to talk to people like you.
But your social media following is incredible. I have like 750,000 people, something like that. You're a wonderful follow, and I have to think part of that success is the positivity you bring to it. How do you approach social media?
I post the exact same way when I had 100 followers as now when I have like 600,000 or 700,000 or whatever is that now. I've got no time for snobbery. I have no time for negativity. And I get upset. I get angry as much as the next person working, and especially now where we're all in a very strange time. But I never saw social media as a place to get angry about something because for a lot of it doesn't really change anything. It may make you feel really good being snarky or insulting somebody, but then you walk away without having to achieve anything. And I think that the more that we could utilize these tools and these technologies that are given to us for positiveness, and it's not all hunky-dory all the time, and I get that, but I get to create the social media life that I want. And I just found that, there's so much anger anyway in the world and there's so much division talking about politics stuff is that I don't have to be that person. So I just choose not to be.
A wonderful follow on Twitter. Check out his SiriusXM show as well, That Eric Alper. And Eric, also thanks so much for setting us up with Andy Kim earlier this week, who was great. David Clayton Thomas tomorrow, Sass Jordan next week. And thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. It's been a blast, and I sure hope we can do it again.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. And thank you so much for all of your enthusiasm. I've listened to a lot of the shows since we connected, and I'm so happy that we found each other, and I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Eric. Be well, stay safe.
You too. We'll talk soon.
That is Eric Alper here on Downtown.